and take it, please.
Music. Hello, music.
Hold on, Steve. We've got music coming. Hold on.
Play that Friday song. That's a good one.
All right, hold on.
I love
that. It's not Friday yet. We can't do it.
It's Friday somewhere.
It's up on the board. We're having a malfunction.
I'll say the world.
Oh, thank you, Steve. This is a great way to start.
All right.
Should we sing?
No, Mary, please. Oh, okay. That would be the worst thing possible.
Well, I like Mary singing.
Mary, if you want to sing, please sing, but the rest of us should not be singing. Well, Mary, actually, Wendy sings pretty good, too.
Wow. What did I do to deserve that? Thank you.
I can't think of a Tuesday song.
Let's just start with this.
Now we're working.
Here we go.
Because, boy, oh, boy, we were talking about it off the air with the Steve Cochran Show. Good morning, by the way. Wendy Snyder, Bill Leff, Steve Bertrand, Mary Vandeveld. I don't know what happened. You watched?
Yeah, absolutely, I watched.
Something was very, very different with the way James Holzhauer played.
I kept thinking to myself, and we've discussed this before, they taped several episodes of Jeopardy in a day. I kept thinking maybe he was just rusty from the weekend, although he did have that 2-week break during the teacher's tournament.
That's when I thought he was going to lose his mojo, but he didn't.
No, he did not.
What started his problem is getting the first daily double with no money. And then
but
you
that's
can...
happened a bunch of times to him.
Yeah, but...
That's happened quite a few times to him.
He didn't seem quick enough.
You can still wager up to $2,000 early on, even if you don't have that much in the bank. But he just never had, like, usually he hits a rhythm and just stayed with it, and that rhythm just never happened yesterday. He was playing two very good contestants. It was no fluke. They were both very, very smart.
Totally.
And quick on the draw.
They were using the buzzer better than he was.
Yeah. Now, to his credit, there's a couple of things.
First of all, he deserves a ton of credit.
He deserves a lot of credit.
I just want to say that.
It's not easy to do what he did over the last month plus. To his credit, upon losing, he quickly walked over to the winner and high-fived her, which I've never seen in Jeopardy history before. Have you? Or a person who was the champion?
For 32 days.
For 32 days.
They never even acknowledge each other usually, which really makes me mad. I thought they were told not to. Is that true?
But he did quite often.
He can do whatever he wants.
Especially during the interview portion. When you got segment two and they ask, you know, to tell a little funny anecdote and it never pays off.
Worst/best part of the show.
Right.
I mean, Alex
always
is awkward, too.
Always awkward. Because it's a story that you could tell these people have in their bank. I got to tell the story about the time I was in Sweden and the guy came up to, I got to tell that story. And then it doesn't pay off. And Alex just, you know.
Says, yeah, but you'd think Alex would do a better job setting them up. He's like, a crazy thing happened to you in grade school.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us about that?
Right.
It's just so awkward.
Right.
I love it.
Yeah. But this time, Jamie Holzhauer several times said words to the effect of, oh, I can't top that. And they just moved on, you know. But normally, yeah, they don't really address each other. But he, on many occasions, when somebody would get a tough answer, he would applaud them.
He moves
not
his
just
hands
yesterday.
Towards them.
Yes.
I don't like when people do that.
But not just yesterday. He'd been doing that all along, and he did congratulate, you know, the winner. I thought it was very strange when he lost. There was very little by way of parting shots from Alex. There was no kind of, wow, you've been an incredible player. We never thought we'd see this reign come to an end, but, you know, today was the day. It was over.
Here's the weird thing. When the show began, and I wish we had the audio for the very beginning, because he introduced the contestants, and he said something to Alex, said something to the effect that, you know, they're here to play, and who knows, James's time may be over. It was really weird.
Like more foreboding than the normal? Like,
yes.
I know something that no one else knows.
Maybe Alex was listening to Cochran yesterday.
Well...
Maybe that's what it was.
I mean, now that I know the result, had I not known the result because of Steve Cochran, perhaps I wouldn't have looked into it. But he said something like, you know, well, these contestants want to be here. And, you know, who knows? Cause James' time may be over. And it just was a weird, like, foreshadowing.
Yeah.
And then James did not seem on the money. He seemed a little slower than usual.
Right.
He wasn't as animated.
I think because early on, they both the two other contestants both established the fact that they were playing. They were not going to sit back. Like, more days than not, Jamie was playing two people that were just sitting back going, well, It's not going to be me today. Let's see how good this guy is. But that didn't happen yesterday. Both guys, the guy and the girl, were just, you know, they were quick on the buzzer. They had the answers. And I think he was so not used to that, you know, that it just, it ate him up.
And here's what I find most curious, Bill. The Final Jeopardy bet.
Yeah?
I've never seen him.
He went low. But I know why.
Okay, explain this to me.
All right.
Because I don't even think that amount would have taken him over her had she not answered correctly.
Well, there's a story about it on MSN where he talked about his fear of he and Emma, the girl who eventually beat him, kind of canceling each other out, and then the guy who was in third place.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, so if they both bet big and didn't know it, they would have canceled each other out, and then the third place guy. So he said he was more mindful of the guy in third place, which ended up being, you know, tragic for him, than he was of Emma. But I said, like, all right, so I started watching him in about the second week of his stretch, right?
Me too.
And I said, boy, there's no whatever category they throw at this guy, he just, it doesn't matter. He just knows it. Except there was a Shakespearean category about, was that 2 weeks ago?
It was fairly recently, yeah.
Where a woman who was playing against him got 4 out of the 5 answers very, very rapidly. And then I don't think anyone got the fifth one. I think there was one that went unanswered. But you could tell that was like the one, his one weakness was that the Shakespearean stuff he wasn't very strong on. He ended up knowing the one yesterday. The answer was Marlowe. He knew that. But I think he played it safe because he goes, oh, this is my weak category of Shakespeare, and that's there it is.
I have never seen him bet so low.
No.
And that's what really confused me.
Yeah, I know.
Ever.
I know.
And that was his, like, strategic plan all along.
Right.
Is, you know.
Right.
And I can't believe she bet the whole thing.
Well, she established early on she was going for it.
Because nothing to lose, everything to gain.
Right. She had.
And she's a librarian, and it's Shakespeare.
Yes. Yes.
She was really good.
I've read a bunch of messages saying, not to us, not to hear us at the station, but about Jamie Holzhauer. Good. You know, we were tired of watching him just mop up the floor with everybody. I disagree. I will miss him tremendously. He's the best thing that happened to Jeopardy in years and years and years.
I was ready for him to lose. Wanted to see, but I wanted to see him lose to my own surprise.
Oh,
I didn't want to know it was his last show. It just really seemed, and we've brought this up a couple times, did Alex like him or dislike him? It's really tough to say. There were times that they had like a special relationship, and then his daughter wrote a get well card for him last night.
Jamie Holzhauer's daughter
yes.
wrote a get well card
did
for
you
Alex
see that
Trebek.
At the
I did
beginning?
Not see that.
So at the very beginning of the show, he talked to everybody, and then he talked to James and had another fun story from James. And then Alex kind of stopped and said, and I want to thank your daughter, I can't remember her name, for making me this get well card.
Nice.
And he held it up.
That's very, very nice.
So, like, that was sweet.
Yeah.
Why was that the first time? I mean, I almost feel like this was foreshadowing that this was going to be the last time we could see him.
Interesting.
We're trying to find that audio at the beginning of the Jeopardy show.
All right, let's do this. We'll take a quick break, and then if we would love to hear from you, 312-981-7200. Did Jeopardy end better or worse than Game of Thrones? That's the topic today. 312-981-7200.
Boy, this brings me back to makeout parties.
From a few weeks
ago?
Eighth grade. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. The Holzhauer era is over, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you enjoyed the Holzhauer era. It came to a crashing halt yesterday afternoon, or yesterday morning if you were listening to Steve Cochran's show. All right, a couple things. Number one, will we ever reach that period? Now, this is about the fact that we were privy to the information that James had lost yesterday. There was a time if you were watching a television show, anything could happen. Like now, I don't know how it happens, but you almost always know when a major character is going to die off on a show. But I remember when I was a kid, you'd watch a show.
And you'd be devastated.
Do you remember the show The White Shadow?
Yeah.
All right,
Ken Howard.
Yeah.
He Salami, was who played that, Van Patten.
Yeah. Yeah, very, wow, very good one.
I played high school basketball. That show was my life.
Yeah, it was a fun show. Do you remember the episode where one of the guys, they were having a party at one of the basketball players' houses, and they ran out of beer, so a guy went to the liquor store to get some beer, and then there was a shooting at the liquor store, and that character, a major character on the show, got shot and killed.
Yep.
And I remember just sitting stunned, going, wait, they couldn't kill that guy off. He's on the show every week. And then a very short time later, maybe a year later on Hill Street Blues, there was a major character on Hill Street Blues. This one I don't even want to give away because if I don't know, is anyone still binge watching Hill Street Blues? But there was a major character on Hill Street that got shot and killed on an episode. And again, I remember a friend of mine calling up and they go, did they just kill him off? Yes, they killed him off. But now people would know in advance somehow. There's no more surprises.
And that's, again, another reason why I hate social media, because a lot, just the internet in general, we find out like so-and-so has just signed on to do a new show. So you're pretty much sure
they're not going to be on their original show.
Yeah. And then The Walking Dead, they did a countdown to, you know, in case people haven't watched it and are binging, but there was a character that they did only 4 more episodes with this person.
Yeah.
But don't do that.
Well, I don't totally agree with you because we certainly didn't know how Game of Thrones was going to end, right?
Right.
I mean, that was a surprise.
I found out yesterday.
Yeah, by a Steve Cochran's show staff member.
Yes.
Boy, that whole morning show ruins everything.
My plan, Steve, was to, I was going to watch it throughout the summer. I was going to start either this week or next week. Mm-hmm. And then, Steve's new producer shared the ending with me.
Well, I think that's their catchphrase. We get up early and tell you first.
get it first, get it fast.
No, that's a different thing.
Yeah.
I am not a conspiracy theorist at all.
Yeah.
In fact, they make me mad.
But
I really think Jeopardy benefited by having the secret out today or yesterday.
Do you really?
And so I almost wonder. Yeah, more people tuned in. More people tuned in yesterday to watch him lose.
To watch history.
Than if they thought the winning streak was probably going to continue.
But the people that were into it were watching it yesterday because he stood a good chance of beating Ken Jennings total yesterday. He was right. He was just on the heels.
Why didn't they just let him do it? I'm telling you, there's something inside here. We found the audio, I believe, of when Alex talked to the two contestants and then went on to say this.
Well, as you just saw, ladies and gentlemen, a very impressive total for our champion, James. He is now just $60,000 away from Ken Jennings' record-setting total of many, many years ago. So we could see a new record set here today. But Jay and Emma maybe don't feel that way. They're not looking forward to that. Perhaps they're thinking, hey, enough is enough. All right, let's
isn't that ominous? Come on.
No, they set it up by saying he could break the record, though.
I don't know.
There were other days where Alex alluded to that, not as much as yesterday. That seemed a little bit much by Trebekian standards.
Doesn't it? I mean, listen, I am not ever a conspiracy theorist, ever. But something's funky with this. Holzhauer's win streak has proven to be a major boon to the game show. The former champion has pushed the show to the number one spot in the syndication ratings. By the end of April, Jeopardy was averaging 12 million viewers, enough to dethrone top syndicated series Judge Judy.
But
had this done.
Judy, she's behind this. All right. If you know the story of Charles Van Doren and the quiz show scandal, and you do, right?
Yeah.
They are so overly policed now.
I know.
Can't do anything that isn't above board because they'll close it down. They have to do everything to the letter.
But they'll never close down Jeopardy. And how can you prove things? Because I was watching with Jim yesterday, and he thought that they might have just put the Daily Double in there as he chose that right away. I'm like, they're not moving it around.
No, they can't do that. Because I even thought, knowing that Shakespeare was his weakness, maybe they had that one on hold, and if it was ever a really close game like it was yesterday, they throw that into Final Jeopardy, and that's the end of him. But they can't do that. It has to be random.
And Bertrand, I kind of understand where you're coming from. Like, people would definitely tune in to see what happened because it was history was made by this guy, and they would have tuned in. Ratings would have been up. But then why didn't... Why? I just feel like something happened where he should have just been able to break the record and then let him go out. I don't. Something's fishy.
How could they do that? They can't do that. Fishy.
You're assuming they controlled the game. I'm not saying that at all. All I'm saying is that it probably didn't hurt them.
If this
was going to be his last day, it didn't hurt them that the word got out,
so that more people would tune in.
Yeah,
I'd be
less likely to tune in if I thought he was going to play for two more weeks. I don't really care, but
yeah.
Like, oh, this is the day he loses, I might be more inclined to tune in.
I guess.
I would say instead of a conspiracy theory, we just write it off as no matter how good you are at whatever you do, there's a day that you're not that good at it. And yesterday
Agreed.
Was that day. He didn't get into that rhythm that he got into every day where he was just automatic. That never happened at any point. He was never just reeling them off one after another after another.
He did not seem up to his usual game yesterday.
No.
And again, the ominous intro from Alex, enough is enough. Right. Who knows? That was weird. And then the fact that his final Jeopardy bid was so low, that was just uncharacteristic of him.
I think that's the part if there was a redo on any part of it, of course, that would be the part where he'd go, I got this far by taking a chance. I'm a gambler. That's what I do. I gamble. Here's my chance to gamble. And he didn't do it.
But that's what confuses me.
Yeah.
I think they said, you know what? Take a little break here, buddy. You can come back for the championship tournament.
All right. So that's the other part of this. At some point, it's going to be him against Ken Jennings. And then there's a third guy. We've gotten texts from some people about a guy who they say never lost on the show. So was this back early on when you could only play for five episodes? Has it been that long since this guy's been on? I don't know his name. But at some point, it's going to be Ken Jennings against Jamie Holzhauer. Who do you think wins that one?
Holzhauer.
I do, too.
Well, Jennings said that, too. He said his mind is older and slower. And
oh.
And, it's more recent that Holzhauer's done it, so he's ready to roll.
Yeah.
He's finger ready.
Yeah, I would put my money on him if it came to that.
All right, very quickly, spell Jeopardy.
J-E-O-P-A-R-D-Y.
You win. I was Googling things this morning, and that is one word that I just cannot spell for the life of me.
How are you spelling it?
I put A-R-D. It just took me a while.
It starts with a J. I'm positive of that.
Are you reading the text? Somebody just texted J-E-P-E-R-D-Y.
Oh, no. But you just...
Jeopardy.
It's one of those words that I got to think about
a couple
of times.
Yeah. All right. Should we take a break?
Yeah, we can do that.
All right. A break and then a lot more show. Still to come, Richard Pryor Jr. will join us. Did you know Richard Pryor Jr. existed? He'll be on to tell us that he does. And then also a book about every Cub that's ever played for the Cubs. It's all coming up. Thanks, Steve. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. We're going to talk about technology with Ashley Escather from CNET in just a little bit. But first, couple of parting shots about James Holzhauer. By the way, we keep getting texts. Every time I mention his name, it's Jamie Holzhauer. People go, it's James. It's not Jamie.
Well, he went by Jamie, and his brother said he goes by Jamie.
In real life, it's Jamie. Yeah. On the show, it's James. It's more formal on the show. But either are correct, I believe. If this were a Jeopardy category, Holzhauer, and my guess was, I said, who is Jamie Holzhauer? I would still get credit, I think.
I'll give you credit.
Thank you. All right. A couple of things. A lot of people saying, by way of text, that he obviously took a dive, that he was bored with the show, that he was tired of being on the show. Who in their right mind would be tired of winning between $50,000 and $100,000 every half hour?
And it makes you an Insta-celebrity.
Right.
He didn't get bored, but he did see...
There's no way he got bored.
Maybe he had the stomach flu.
Are you saying complacent, maybe?
You know, I don't even think complacent.
I've never seen him once, so I don't know.
Oh, you never saw it, Steve?
No.
He was not his usual enthusiastic self, even in the beginning when they show their face. He did a little something, but usually he kind of mugs and does crazy things.
Right.
He was not the usual James Holzhauer I'm used to seeing.
Right. So you think there were two James Holzhauers?
No, I'm not saying
Interesting.
That.
Interesting. Here's a great text. Hi, Wendy and Bill. Maybe I'm the only one, but I hated, all caps, hated James's run. It wasn't any fun just watching one guy reel off answer after answer. It's not a contest then, it's just a showcase. I think they should go back to limiting the number of wins that the contestant can have. Maybe five is too few, but how about 10? P.S. I've been a Jeopardy fan since the Art Fleming days. As have I. I used to watch that as a kid. That's a tough one. The thing I liked most was exactly what that texter just described. I liked the way he was just like a machine. I've never seen anything like him on the show before. I've seen a lot of good people on the show, but I never saw anybody like that who just didn't seem to have a weakness.
Well, the answer's in the ratings, right?
Yes. I mean,
what are the ratings
done? Yes,
run?
And it took me, James Holzhauer, to start watching Jeopardy again. Always loved the game, but yeah. I never watched it every single day with James on there. And I didn't like him or hate him. I played along. I like showing off my smartness at home.
I felt like I was watching, I attribute a lot of things to sports. I draw some sort of a line to sports, but it was like watching Roger Federer play tennis. It was like watching Babe Ruth play baseball. He was just that good. And over the years, how many hundreds, if not thousands, of contestants have we seen on Jeopardy who are good? You got to be good to get on Jeopardy, but he just played it at a whole new level. He was so good. I'm shocked he lost. I was trying to imagine a scenario where months from now they were saying to him, hey, we got to figure something out because we've had you on the show for 5 months, 6 months. What are we doing?
I told you I expected to be watching till Christmas with him on.
Yeah.
It just seemed, I don't know what to tell you. It just didn't seem like the guy I've been watching for the last month.
So what?
Well, but Wendy, that's because he lost.
No, you didn't watch it, Steve. So I mean, just his energy level, his betting, it was all different and not his typical way of playing.
He's not. I would never put him under the blanket of cockiness. I didn't see cockiness, but there was a self-assured.
He's a little cocky. He should be.
I guess a little cocky, but not overly cocky, but he just had this way, this self-assured, hey, I'm really good at this.
I got this.
So, and that wasn't there yesterday.
All right, so I don't know how to say her name, and I apologize, and Matt, you should probably listen to how her name is said. The woman who took him down yesterday, Emma Betcher, 27-year-old, user experience librarian here in Chicago. She auditioned to appear on the game show four times, beginning in her senior year of high school.
Wow.
And as for preparation, she says, I looked up some tutorials online about how to wager, especially for the final Jeopardy. That seemed to pay off for her.
Yes.
But I also knew that a large part of the game for me was the mental aspect, keeping focused while being on the set of my favorite TV show. Betcher walked away with $46,801 on Monday's episode. She brought an end to Holzhauer's attempt to break the all-time Jeopardy earnings record. And they did bring up that she did her master's paper on predicting the difficulty of trivia questions using Jeopardy clues as part of the study while she was at University of North Carolina. That's
wow,
pretty interesting.
Interesting.
So she's like a Jeopardy expert.
Yeah, I guess she is. I'm being told by Matt in the booth that Brad Rutter is the third Jeopardy contestant. Now they said, I've received two texts that say he's the guy that's never lost. So,
well, then why isn't he still on?
I'm confused by that, unless he predated the five-game rule. So for a long time, for years and years on Jeopardy, you could only be a winner five times, and then they moved you out. But that changed, I don't know, 20 years ago, maybe?
Matt, you can say that on the air. Matt has some information.
Right.
Matt is our intern who's now, like, producing our show. Jasmine's training him and doing a great job.
Well, Brad Rutter, he has the record for the most money ever won, and he lost to a computer when they did the IBM contest.
Yeah.
It was him and Jennings.
Against the IBM computer.
Yeah, and that's how he lost.
Well, that doesn't count. They should have let him come back.
It's like fighting against the Terminator.
You gotta have a human contestant.
I know.
They're just making it up.
Is that the way game shows are going in the future? Is they'll just throw a robot on against you? That's going to ruin Family Feud.
No kisses.
Steve Harvey's not going to kiss a computer again. You can fool him once, but he's smart.
All right. Well, congratulations to everybody. It really got me watching that show again. I have to tell you, I don't know if I'm going to go home and watch it every day now.
I so looked forward. On my way home, I would work out, and I would come home, and Jeopardy was starting just as I'd walk in the door, and I loved it. And now that's gone.
Well, I have to see how this woman who works, she's at the UIC library, correct? I believe she is.
Yeah, I think that is correct.
And I don't know how to say her name, but congratulations.
Emma, it's pronounced Emma.
Maybe she's going to be on for 30 days now. Maybe it's the start of a whole new thing.
Oh, that's interesting. Do you think she will be?
Could have. She was pretty smart, and her buzzer work was miraculous.
Now, what happens with Jamie/James? Does he show up somewhere else? Does he get a job in the media where we get to see him with some regularity? Or does he just kind of fall away? Because Ken Jennings was around for a while. After Jeopardy, he did other game shows. He'd show up on things.
I interviewed him on a book tour for Barnes & Noble.
Oh, did you, Steve?
Yeah.
By the way, it's U of C, not UIC, University of Chicago, that Emma teaches, or is a librarian at.
Yeah.
Matt, you're doing a good job, but now too good where you're correcting us all the time.
Right.
Because
you're going to have to start coming in and do extra time.
Right,
here
and stay after late.
Yes, yes.
And then we'll issue a bunch of apologies the next day.
Yeah.
All right, it's a Tech Tuesday. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk to Ashley Esqueda from CNET.com. iTunes is going away.
I don't know if it's going away. They're rebranching it. It's going to
we'll
be different.
Out.
We'll find out. All right, stick around. Bill and Mundy, WGN.
Bill, that music can only mean that it is a Tech Tuesday. Ashley Esqueda is on the line with us. She's the senior producer over at CNET. And Ashley, I have heard that iTunes is going away. Am I wrong in this assumption?
It is. You're not wrong. It is. Rest in peace, iTunes. Let's all pour one out.
It really is, Bill. It's
wait, they can't do. I just figured out how to use it a week ago. You can't do that to me.
You're not alone. I still there are parts of iTunes I still don't know how to use. So, WWDC was started yesterday, and that is Apple's developer conference. They like to call it Dub for short, which I will never call it because that is ridiculous.
Yep.
But they have their big keynote. It was over 2 hours long. They had a lot of product or a lot of software that they wanted to show off. This is usually when they show off a preview of what we're going to see for our Macs and iPhones in the coming year. They absolutely did that. They did show off some new hardware. There was a new Mac Pro. So iTunes is, in fact, going away. So what Apple has decided is iTunes has gotten a little bit unwieldy because not only it started off as a music program, and now it kind of handles movies and TV, and it also handles podcasts, and it's kind of all over the place. And so what they've decided is in the next iteration of OS X, which will be called Catalina, keeping with the theme of places in California that are very pretty and treasured by many, they are going to split up iTunes. So iTunes technically is breaking up into three pieces. So it'll be Apple Music, Apple TV, and also Apple Podcasts. So they're gonna split it up into three pieces, and it'll be three different apps. Which, especially with Apple's streaming service that's coming up, which they did show a preview of. They showed a really cool preview called For All Mankind, and it is a show about an alternate history where the Russians win the space race to the moon and how we respond to that. So they're going to be launching that streaming service. So it made a lot of sense for them to sort of split all three up. But don't worry, Bill. Apple Music looks a whole heck of a lot like iTunes as it currently exists. So it just won't have the TV and other things that you're used to seeing in there right now.
You'll need a new app.
Oh, so will I?
Oh.
Uh-oh. All right, so for me, I'm one of those guys. I've got, you know, hundreds of songs on iTunes, you know, and mm-hmm. what will I have to do to transfer them over to their new system? Is there anything I can do?
So the good news is when you upgrade to Catalina, which usually is a free upgrade, a free software upgrade, You'll upgrade, and it will automatically transfer all of your playlists, your library. All of that will be transferred into the new Apple Music app as you upgrade. So you won't have to do anything that's intensive, or you won't have to, you know, manually move things, or you won't have to do any of that.
Okay. All right. And I can still download music just like the old days. That hasn't changed, right? Everything's...
None of that has changed.
It has changed.
None of that has changed. It's very much like your experience in Apple Music on an iPhone. So even if you subscribe to the monthly Apple Music service, you can download tracks, while you subscribe. If you are a subscriber, you can even download tracks directly to your device.
Right.
So it'll be the same on your computer.
Wasn't Apple the very first person and company to create this downloadable type music? iTunes was what it was all about.
Yeah.
That was the first one that really kind of broke the barrier. I know, like, there was that period of time where it was, you know, either you were
doing it illegally.
Either you were doing it illegally via like Napster or LimeWire, or you were buying it legally through places like iTunes, or you were ripping. You would buy a CD at like your local Blockbuster or your Sam Goody, and then you would rip the CD into MP3s, and then you could load those onto your device.
A listener wants to know by way of text if they have to hurry up and use their iTunes gift cards quickly. Do you know the answer to that?
I think you probably should be just fine.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Because I would imagine that the point of sale for anything happening in iTunes is probably going to be, it all still goes through kind of the iTunes store.
Yeah.
And so I can't imagine that changing. And I think Apple would probably make a pretty big deal about if your gift cards were going to expire. I'm sure there would be a very big announcement made. So we have not heard anything to that effect. So I would imagine you're okay to hold on to your gift cards if you are feeling like a little concerned that they won't be good anymore.
All right. Okay.
All right. Now, people that want to apply for a visa to live or work in the United States have to give some other information. Explain this story. Boy, we have blasted into the 2000s.
We really have. So people outside of the U.S. applying for a work visa now have to also give their social media handles
to the platform for the process. I have to get one?
If you don't have one, you can say that. But I would imagine most people do. There are people who have, 2 billion people have a Facebook account. So I would imagine that I don't think they're going to be, here's my TikTok, officer. You can watch all my best hits, my best music videos on TikTok. But it is a new way to scan for potential dissidents, or obviously the Department of Homeland Security feels that this will also help with terrorism. It is a little bit concerning because obviously when you hear about the government monitoring social media and maybe making lists of people's social media accounts who maybe have unfavorable views toward the government, when we have the First Amendment, that is something for us to all think about, whether or not we're okay with that. The immigration departments all feel that this is a requirement. We have to kind of move that scanning background check process into the 21st century, and social media, they feel, is a big part of that.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And finally today, Ashley Esqueda from CNET.com. There have been these mysterious light flashes on the moon, and I don't know what they are. Do you know? They could be UFOs, moonquakes, meteors. But there's a new telescope that can give us more information. Explain this.
This story is very strange, and before I just really briefly talk about it, I want to encourage anybody interested in outer space news to watch a show that we produce called Watch This Space. It's with our Australian senior editor Claire Riley. It's very funny. but also she is really good at explaining all of these different things that go on in outer space. And so if there's news about space and you feel like you want to know a little bit more, you can always watch that show. So this new telescope is going to investigate these light flashes on the moon, which is at first it sounds very mysterious, but it's actually thought to be an impacting meteoroid. So as these meteoroids kind of land on the moon and they make their hits, they will make these sort of light flashes. But this new telescope is in Spain, and they call the flashes of light the lunar transient phenomena, which sounds very fancy. And they believe that this new telescope is going to be able to, it has cameras on it that watch the moon every single night for these phenomena. And they are going to take pictures and video sequences of the event, and then they're going to compare their results with the European Space Agency, who also, obviously, like, they're sort of the EU's NASA. They're always keeping an eye on the moon. So they're going to kind of compare and contrast and see exactly if they can nail down exactly what this is. But they believe almost very similarly to, do you guys remember the meteors that we've seen kind of got captured on dash cams in Russia and in Chicago? So they think whether these bright flashes of light before they, you know, kind of burn out, they think it's similar to that. So obviously the moon doesn't have an atmosphere the way Earth does, so there's not as much heat happening when it enters our atmosphere, there's not as much heat as it does when it enters Earth's atmosphere compared to the moon. But they believe that these are meteoroids that are hitting the surface and sort of creating these bright flashes of light. So they're hoping to be able to kind of confirm that with this telescope in Spain.
Space is the final frontier, and it really intrigues me. And you can find Watch This Space. It's on YouTube, but it's kind of through CNET, correct?
Yeah, it's on CNET's YouTube channel.
Okay.
So you can go anytime in that. I believe they put them up every couple of weeks or whenever there's really good space news. And it's very, and you can go watch back episodes too. They're really informative, and Claire is very funny. She likes to kind of have fun with it as sort of this like pulpy, you know, 1950s news about space. She's really great. She makes it really fun and really informative, and I cannot recommend it enough. It's fantastic if you love space news.
I love space news.
You saying it's the final frontier, Wendy? Can I can quote you on that?
Yes, you can.
Excellent. Very good. Ashley, thanks so much. Have a great week. We'll talk to you in 7 days.
Thank you. I think I'll see you in 2 weeks. I have to go to E3 next week and check out all the newest video games.
Oh, fun.
Oh, you
all
poor
right.
baby.
Yeah, that's a rough assignment.
Oh, I know. Gosh, they had to really twist my arm for that one, you guys.
Thanks for taking one for the team. We appreciate it.
Thanks. Bye.
Ashley Escay, the senior producer over at CNET, coming up, the stories that matter with Steve Bertrand from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN Radio. Thanks, Steve. It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder. Without a doubt, Richard Pryor was one of the best that ever was when it came to stand-up comedy. His son, Richard Pryor Jr., joins us right now to talk about a book that he's written about his own life and the life of his dad. It's called In a Pryor Life. How are you, Richard? Nice to talk to you.
I'm doing good. How are you?
Really good.
I am fascinated to find out more about your life because doing a little research before having you on, you have done a lot of interesting things in your life, have you not?
I know it's been crazy roller coaster ride my whole life. It's ups and downs and to the valleys and everything else, good, bad, and ugly, all of it. So, you know, but it put me where I am today, you know, in the place where I am today, and I'm peaceful and confident and all those things that in order to go through things, you have to get somewhere, so... You know, I'm not dissatisfied with it. You know, it was my life, you know.
And your book can totally help someone. Let's start at the beginning, 1962, Peoria. You are born the first son of Richard Pryor.
Right. Yeah, that was a, you know, I tell people this story a lot, and people are like shocked. And, you know, you think about your mother and how loving your mother is, and the first words that come out of her mouth, what did I have, a freak? You know, it's like, so it's like I was born into chaos.
Yeah. And in fact, you went on to live with whom? Not your mother.
Well, I lived with my mother, and I lived with my mother's mother
okay.
for a while, and I also lived with my great-grandmother as well. She was the Madame Miranda Pool Hall, my dad's mother, grandmother. Yeah.
But
which is crazy.
The family business, Richard, was prostitution, wasn't it?
Prostitution and bootlegging.
Yeah. So you would say that's probably not the ideal surroundings for a child to be brought up in. Obviously,
well,
you know that.
It was. Now I look back and look how different it was. But when I was coming up in that, you know, I thought it was normal. You know, yeah, I didn't think anything different of hearing the, you know, the curse words and, you know, 4 and 5 years old, you're selling bottles of liquor to the people, you know,
wow.
who were coming by, and, you know, so it was normal to me until I got older and would, you know, travel around and go to other kids' homes and don't see that. It's a big difference. It's a shock.
All right, so you've done some acting. You were in the Navy. Mm-hmm. What else have you done?
Navy, I was a ordained minister. I was a female impersonator.
And you looked very attractive, if I may say. The pictures, you were really pretty hot.
Thank you.
Wendy doesn't say that to all of our guests,
no,
Richard, so it means something.
Cool.
Now, wait, were you a female impersonator while you were in the Navy?
Well, that's when I actually first started, right, when I was in the Navy. That's when I was introduced to it. And we were like in Edinburgh, in Scotland, and, you know, I did a lip sync thing. I started lip syncing this song, and the next day they let us in free. And when I got back to the States, I started doing it to see how I would do as far as actually doing the show.
We're talking with Richard Pryor Jr.
It's like my jaw is dropping with everything
amazing.
You
it's
say.
Amazing.
I mean, seriously.
Richard's book is called In a Prior Life, talking about his own life and the life of his dad. All right, so a couple of questions about your dad. Question number one, Richard, is this. Do you think that if your dad hadn't come from such unconventional surroundings, he would have achieved the pinnacle of comedy like he did? Do you think he kind of needed that to spark him, that strange upbringing? What do you think?
I totally agree. I don't think that the humor part of him was always there, just like it is with me. But I think he had an edge because of his upbringing and the things he came out of. And, you know, I'm sure other people came out of things of that nature, but he was the one to talk about it. Because a lot of people would be hush-hush on all those things and want to keep those things a secret. But he wanted to share those things, and I think him sharing that was something that really boosted his career as far as being authentic and being real.
And did you go with him, what was it, to the Tonight Show? Did you ever escort him on his stand-up travels?
Yeah, I traveled with him when I was, early teens and mid-teens, when I was actually introduced him on stage. And those were things that was phenomenal. I think that's when I realized that my dad was, you know, a performer, you know, like a star, when, you know, to watch him and watch the crowd and how they reacted with, you know, when he came on stage, he would just tell his stories. He was an awesome storyteller.
He was such a storyteller. Unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you see him dabbling with drugs? Because it seems like you were around as a teenager as he's in these clubs and these performances. Did you witness any of that?
Yeah, I did. There was one time I thought I was looking at a 5-pound bag of sugar, and it really wasn't. You know, and when you're seeing those things, you're not understanding. Am I seeing what I think I'm seeing? It was kind of like on my mother's side of the family, you didn't see those things. You know, you saw the alcohol, but you didn't see the drug use and everything like that. So I was around it, but wasn't aware of actually what it was until I got much older.
And then did you have your own battles with it?
Oh, of course I had my own battles. You know, like father, like son, you know, whether it was trying to emulate my father or to be just like him. And when you also go through peer pressure and all those things and the things I went through when I was younger as well, I think all those added created that, so to speak, a storm, so to speak.
Yeah.
How would you rate him as a father, Richard? Your dad was, you couldn't even argue the fact that he was such a great performer, entertainer, stand-up comedian.
Right.
But what about as a dad? Where would you put him?
Well, what I've said in the past to other people that have asked me the question, I said my dad was the best father he knew how to be. He wasn't a perfect father, which, you know, parents aren't born with a book or anything like that of knowing how to raise a child. I think he did the best he knew how. One thing that
he had a thing with us, like he would purchase us things and give us money and all those things. And I think those were things where he was trying to be but the dad. And a lot of times when you just wanted your dad and not the things. So those were some things where he, you know, I'm not going to say really fell short, but things that he didn't know. It was because he had to go by where he was raised and how he was being presented to him and how he was shown love. So it was kind of like the same way.
And he had such a different life from you. You're staying with your mother and your grandmother, and you have to take out the garbage and do chores, and then you go spend some time with your dad in California, and you had people like at your beck and call, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. It was totally a flip side. Going to my dad's and spending time with my dad. But, you know, I thank my mother for who she was as a person because it kept me grounded. And it didn't allow me to have a big head or a big ego or anything like that. You know, like, do your chores, do what you're supposed to do. So I've always been like that.
We're talking with Richard Pryor Jr., the son, of course, of the great Richard Pryor. His book is called In a Pryor Life. It's available at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, wherever books are sold. We'll take a quick break and then continue our discussion. If you'd like to jump in, you can at 312-981-7200. You can call us there or text us there. Spill Laugh, it's Wendy Snyder. Our guest is Richard Pryor Jr. As you can guess, Richard Pryor Jr. is the son of the great Richard Pryor, one of the finest, if not the finest, stand-up comedian of all time. Richard, I never got a chance to ask your dad this, so by proxy, I'm going to ask you this. I need you to explain something to me. I'm offended by the N-word. When I hear people use the N-word, it's very offensive to me. Your dad used it quite often in his stand-up, and I'm not kidding when I say this. I never heard it. It blended so effortlessly into everything he said, and it made sense. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think a lot of times when people are telling their truth, the actual way they live, not just throwing something out there as a filler.
Yeah.
I think that's what the difference was, because that was his life. That's the way everyone talked, you know, in his family, and it was prevalent there. But I do, however, know that years later, when he was still performing, he actually went to Africa, and he came back and said he was never going to use that word again, and he never did.
Wow.
Interesting.
What transpired in Africa that brought him to that conclusion, do you think?
Because the word wasn't used there. You didn't see that. You saw black people that looked like him, and you didn't hear the word. There was no, that word didn't exist over there.
Right.
So I think that was the thing where he said he would never call anyone that word again, because he saw really what it really was and what it represented.
Wow.
Now, you kept a relationship with your father up until his death, didn't you?
Yeah, up until probably 6 years prior to his death, his so-called wife, she stopped me from seeing my father, so I didn't get to see him for 6 years. And then when I finally saw him was in January of 2005, and I had to tell my mother had died 2 years prior, which he didn't know because of the circumstances with his wife. But I was able to tell him that I loved him and, you know, shared with him about my mother passing and all those things. I knew that when I saw him in that January of 2005 would probably be the last time I would see him. It was just something I felt in my spirit.
I know your dad has several children by different women. Do you have a relationship with any of your brothers and sisters at all, Richard?
Oh, definitely. Especially Rain. Rain and I are really, really close. We speak almost daily. We're in each other's lives quite a bit. So, and she's the closest to me. She lives in Baltimore. I'm in New York City, so we're not that far apart. So we visit each other and support each other in everything that we do.
Is she still doing stand-up comedy? She did for years.
She's not doing stand-up now, but she's still doing a one-woman show. They're working on developing that into something big. So they're working on that. She's still touring doing that show, and she's doing a lot of speaking. She's also working with the bullying in schools, especially within the Baltimore School District.
Good for her. I know that this book came out, a couple of months ago, and you went to your hometown of Peoria to Bradley University for a little talk and the book release. How'd that go? Did you get a warm reception, I hope?
I had a really warm reception. I didn't know, because you never know as far as Peoria is concerned, because Peoria is its own beast, you know? So you never really know what you're going to get or if people are going to support you, because there's times when, you know, I've done things in Peoria where you're not supported. And I don't know if it's the mentality of the people or
just where they're stuck at, and, you know, don't see, you know, that they can do better as far as say they do, as far as support and all those things, as far as artists and all those things. I think those things are really important. I think that Peoria was lacking in that a lot. But when the book came out, it was like just an eye-opening experience for me of how I was judging how I was going to be received, and it was totally opposite of the way I was received.
Wow.
So I enjoyed it. Yeah.
Well, it sure sounds like you had a crazy emotional roller coaster of a life. I can't wait to read this. In a prior life, there's a sweet picture of you and your dad on the cover, and you can really see you look like him. Just adorable.
that coming up with that title was very catchy, I thought, in a prior life. But, you know, being able to show, you know, my story as far as what I've gone through, that was the most important thing, because when I first started writing the book, I was just writing about a child of a celebrity. By the time I was finished, I wanted to help people. Who could I help that are struggling and going through some things? So I think it achieved exactly what I wanted, because people are opening their eyes to it, and they're supporting me because of it, and all those things. And there's actually one lady that actually purchased, I don't know how many books, a lot of books, to give to one of the homeless shelters in Los Angeles. Aww. As far as to show people, you know, how you can come out of your darkness.
Richard, when I think of your dad, there are certain images that are in my head forever. There's him with Gene Wilder in some of the movies they made together, Stir Crazy or Silver Streak. There's him hosting Saturday Night Live, doing some of the skits on Saturday Night Live. What's the moment that's frozen in your head? If I say close your eyes and think about your dad, what's the image that comes up?
He did a film called Which Way Is Up.
Yeah.
Where he played three characters in the film.
Yeah.
And I think that's, to me, embodied a lot of things as far as his life. And, you know, characters came to life that he actually grew up with. You know, my great-grandfather and my great-grandmother. Those things came out in those characters, and being able to see that, I think that was his great body of work as far as comedy is concerned. Unfortunately, if you watch it on TV, regular TV, it doesn't have the same humor as watching it like on a DVD, because they don't have to cut things out.
Right.
So once they started chopping it up, it didn't resonate as well as it is seeing the actual version.
Well, it's such a pleasure to meet you. You're on social media. Just look up the Richard Pryor Jr. on Facebook or Twitter and Instagram at Richard Pryor Jr. It is a pleasure to speak to you. And In a Prior Life is the book. You can get it wherever your favorite books are sold. And we appreciate you taking the time today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks, Richard. It's Richard Pryor Jr., everybody. Again, the book is called In a Prior Life, available wherever books are sold. Well, we here in the studio just witnessed something very strange. Rick Kempfer's here. He has written a book called Every Cub Ever about every player that's ever played for the Chicago Cubs. And he handed a copy to you, Wendy. And upon touching this Cub book, smoke and fire started to come out of your hands and the book.
All right. First of all, that's Rick's joke.
Thank you, Rick.
Rick Kempfer is here, and the book in question is Every Cub Ever. Rick walked in, and Bill's like, this is amazing. And I didn't have a chance to say it. Rick said, you know, Bill, here's a copy. Bill says, I already have one. Wendy, would you like, well, it'll probably, what did you say? It'll
burn in your hands.
Yeah.
And it did.
Yes. Well, I got to tell you,
it's like throwing holy water on a vampire.
I am a Sox fan. I was in it when the Cubs won the World Series. I had turned around a little bit.
Yes.
And so I will say now to a Cub fan out there, this is the best book ever.
Thank you. You know, I was inspired during that season by Bill's parody song of Jake Arrieta.
Oh, thank you.
Well, we got to find that.
Which, if you got that somewhere, I'd love to hear that.
Did it change your life?
Again. Yes, it did.
So many have said over the years.
It made me want to write this book.
Oh, good. Good. I'm glad some good came out of it, Rick.
That's exciting. You're a lifelong Cubs fan.
I am. Since 1968, I went to my first game with my Uncle Manny, who lived on Lakewood, you know, like three blocks away from Wrigley Field. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's been a lifelong love-hate affair. And here it is. It's I handed this book into my co-publisher, Dave, and he said to me, this is about every Cub ever.
Yes.
Yes. He said, have you ever kissed a girl?
Well, how long did this take you?
It took me 10 years.
All right, so you had time to kiss some girls in between some of the
women. Wow, much your wife's chagrin.
Right.
Yes. Sorry, Bridget.
Here's the beauty of this. So every guy, as the title would imply, everyone who's ever put on a Cub uniform and taken to the field, they're all featured in this book.
Right.
And then you have, sometimes it's just a paragraph, because sometimes it's a guy that was only on for a couple of games or something like that. But then sometimes you get a really deep, rich story about everything about that guy.
Yeah, I was looking for stories as opposed to stats, you know, because you can get in a book, you know, Baseball Reference online, you can see all the stats.
Yeah.
But the stories behind these guys intrigued me. And it was the guys that had played like one inning in one game, you know, like the Moonlight Graham in Field of Dreams.
Yeah.
There's tons of stories like that in Cubs history.
Yeah.
Wait, let's just reminisce for a second. This fabulous song that inspired one Rick Kempfer.
Oh, Arrieta, Jacob Arrieta, Arrieta, he's my favorite Cub. Almost pitched a perfect game, destined for the Hall of Fame. Freeze the frame, shout his name, perfect game, Hall of Fame. Oh, Arrieta, Jacob Arrieta, Arrieta, he's my favorite Cub. Doesn't give up many hits, enjoys a hot dog and some Schlitz. Many hits, have a Schlitz, perfect game, Hall of Fame. Oh, Arrieta, Jacob Arrieta, Arrieta, he's my favorite Cub. Give him his Cy Young Award, Martin Milner, Kent McCord, Young Award, Kent McCord. Many
right,
hits,
you don't have to play
Schlitz,
all of it.
Hall of Fame.
You just have to get in Kent McCord's name, and then everybody's
the best
happy.
That's line, and I just want to give that earworm to everybody, because
thank you
it's
for
fantastic.
That one. Thank you for that. All right, so let's go individually through some of these guys,
okay.
And I would like to start, if it's okay with you, with Carmen Fanzone.
Okay, I love Carmen Fanzone. He was the backup infielder for the Cubs in the early 70s, played second base and third base.
But best known for what he played.
He played the trumpet.
The trumpet.
Yes. And there was I actually spoke to Carmen Fanzone.
Did you really?
While I was writing this book. And there was a legend that he played in the Tonight Show Band.
Yeah.
And it was in Wikipedia. And I said, you know, is that true? Did you play for the Tonight Show Band? He said, no, never did. But I hung out with those guys, and they were my drinking buddies.
Really?
Oh.
Yeah. So it's sort of a true story, but
yeah.
Not really.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's still pretty cool.
He also wore number 23, one of the last ones before
Sandberg.
Brian Sandberg.
Yeah, changed everything. When the Cubs won the World Series, the next day we were trying to figure out which great Cub we should have on to talk about what this means to the city of Chicago. And the name that hit me, I know this is a crazy one, but Bert Hooten. I wanted to have Bert Hooten on, and we did. What can you tell us about Bert Hooten?
Bert Hooten pitched a no-hitter in his fourth start for the Cubs. And I was a little kid. I watched the last inning.
Remember what Brickhouse said?
No.
Hey, a no-hitter for the kid. That's what he said at the end.
I believe it. I believe it. But I did see that. I saw that on TV, and that had a huge impact on me. I loved Bert Hooten.
Yeah.
He was traded to the Dodgers, I think, in the Rick Monday trade.
Yeah. Had one of the great baseball nicknames of all time, Happy, because he never smiled once.
That's right.
Never, ever smiled, so the teammates called him Happy.
I like true. That.
Yeah.
That was the other fun part was, if you go on Baseball Reference, you see sometimes they'll put like their nicknames on there.
Yeah.
And like there was a guy named Steam Engine in Boots. That was his nickname.
That's a long nickname.
Now that sounds like a fun story, right? There's got to be a story there. So I did some research. It took me a long time to find this, but he apparently used to he created that nickname for himself. He's one of these guys that, you know,
really, you can do that.
From now on, you call me Steam Engines and Boot, or you know, whatever. And then he would sign in to every hotel SEIB or whatever the letters are for that, and it never caught on.
I wonder why.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
All right, this is a sad one because of what just happened last week. But we lost Bill Buckner.
Yeah.
What's the story behind Bill Buckner?
So he won a batting title as a Cub. Bill Buckner was very close to being a Hall of Famer.
Yep.
He was that good of a player. I think, as someone said the other day, no Cub player. He only struck out three times in a game once.
Wow.
In his entire
career.
Jeez.
Or maybe zero times. I can't remember. One or the other. He was that good of a contact hitter.
I remember them saying he never struck out more than 40 times in a season.
Exactly.
There's players that do that in a month now. He never did it in a season.
Yeah, he would walk more, you know, many times more.
Yeah.
Do either of you have a favorite Cub? It's pretty hard to pinpoint it to one, isn't it?
Mine was Mine was Jose Cardenal.
Ah.
Just because he had that big fro and, you know, he wore the hat and it barely, you know, it just would rest on the top of his head.
And once missed a game because he couldn't open one of his eyes.
Right. Yeah. Another time he missed the game because he said there were crickets in his room and they kept him up all night.
Oh, I could see that. And it's a great dad joke to use for Father's Day when you have a cardinal in your yard. I always would say, oh, look, there's a cardinal. Must be Jose.
Met him once. I met him at the Jewel in Mount Prospect. I was there with my two older sons and we were in the produce section. And I looked over and I'm like, oh, is that who I think it is? And I said, wait here, boys. I put them by the oranges and I walked over to the onions and Jose was there. And I said, excuse me, I don't want to interrupt anything.
Yeah.
Are you Jose Cardenal? He goes, well, yes, I am.
Oh, wow.
And I said, well, you know what? What are you doing? It was in the winter. I said, what are you doing here in Chicago? He said, I live here. This is my town. I live here year round.
Really?
I said, you're from Cuba.
Right.
He goes, yeah, I love it here. So a Cuban lives in Chicago in the winter for, you know, because he loves us.
I always pictured Jose Cardenal. You know how a little leaguer, when the game is over, they ride their bike home in their uniform? I pictured Jose Cardenal walking around when the game's over still wearing his uniform.
Do you ever go to a signing when you were a kid? And the players are wearing street clothes.
Throws, yeah.
You're looking like, what the?
You can't wear street clothes.
Exactly.
Put your uniform
26.
On.
What are you doing?
Come on. The book is called Every Cub Ever because, well, it features every Cub ever. Not an exaggeration. Yeah. If they ever played for the Cubs anytime between 1871 and modern day and today, they are featured in this book, Every Cub Ever. Rick Hempfer's our guest.
Wouldn't that be a great Father's Day gift?
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because Father's Day's coming.
It is coming
up. You could almost get this for your dad for Father's Day.
It's almost a perfect gift.
Oh, it's so perfect. All right, we'll take a quick break and then more with Rick Hempfer. Stick around. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Still laughing at 20, Snyder. Our guest is Rick Hempfer. He has written a book called Every Cub Ever. And Rick says, with Father's Day a week and a half away, wouldn't be the worst thing in the world to get a dad who loves the Cubs.
If dad loves the Cubs, he'll love this book.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go through a couple more names really quickly.
Okay.
Joe Wallace, outfielder.
Tarzan,
as they called him.
Yes.
Why?
Very speedy.
Loincloth?
Yes, he only wore a loincloth, and he had a monkey next to him all the time in center field.
He would jump. You know, he was like a he was a good fielding outfielder, and he was very hairy.
Yes.
Yes. He had giant hair, big beard and everything, and so Tarzan was an appropriate name for him. Glenn Allen Hill was the guy who hit the home run over the fence.
500 feet.
Onto the rooftop of the... Waveland Avenue,
yes.
On the other side of the street.
Yes,
500 feet.
He also had muscles on top of him. He was the most built human being I've ever seen in my life.
That's true. And as it turned out, according to the Mitchell Report years later, there was a reason for that.
Right.
Had some help.
Purchased.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you have any of the vendors in this book, or is that going to be a different book?
No, but I do have the broadcasters in here, and you know, I did an appearance with George Will recently, the columnist, and he's a Cubs fan.
Yeah,
and he was super excited to get this book, and the first thing he did was to look up to see if his favorite announcer, Burt Wilson, was in here, who I had never heard of before I wrote this book.
I don't know who that is either. Who is that?
He was the announcer in the early 50s.
Burt Wilson, for TV or radio?
For radio. And George Will grew up downstate Illinois and listened to the radio, and Burt Wilson was his guy, and he's in the book.
Here's a question about the Cubs announcers. Yes. Without a doubt, Harry Carey has gone down as just an icon of Chicago sports.
We had him first.
We had him first. The White Sox did have him first. Was Jack Brickhouse slighted at all by all the love and the attention that Harry Carey received?
I think he was, yes. Yeah. He absolutely was. I'd spoken to his widow, Pat, many times.
Yeah.
And I don't think I'm talking out of school to say that she was miffed by that.
Yeah.
Because he got that statue outside of Wrigley Field. And,
right.
And Brickhouse got, you know, hey on the foul pole.
That's it.
And Brickhouse had been there for 50 years.
I know.
Doesn't seem fair.
Yeah.
I know. What was the biggest surprise you came across when writing the book, Rick?
Well, I was telling you earlier, I didn't know that they didn't sell beer at Wrigley Field. They didn't sell any liquor before Prohibition. And so You know, it was not a part of the experience. But the funny part was the Cubs, during Prohibition, led the league in arrests because for drinking. For the players.
Yeah.
There were more than a dozen players on the Cubs that were arrested for drinking during Prohibition, which is far and away the most of any club in
That's crazy. Yeah.
I want to know about Jittery Joe Barry, who played with the Cubs 1904 to 1958, or no, he was a Cubs 1942.
Jittery Joe Barry, if I remember right, and I'm not looking at the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I believe he pitched for the Cubs during the war. He was a very old rookie, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh.
How old does it say in there?
Yeah. It 37-year-old rookie.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So in the war, they brought in a lot of guys.
Yeah.
He was a very thin man, tipping the scales at no more than 135 pounds. How thin was he? Do you remember this?
Yeah, he was blown off the mound by the wind one time when he was pitching.
That thin?
Yeah, he's thin.
135
How
pounds.
How thin was he? Yes.
That's awesome.
There have been a few players that have played for the Cubs multiple times. Like, they'll be with them for a couple years, right, then they'll play elsewhere. It seemed like when we were kids, Bob Locker got traded between the Cubs and Oakland every season. They just That's keep true. Trading them back and forth, back and forth.
They traded Bob Locker. They traded Bill North, who ended up being a big part
Center
of their
fielder.
Their World Series teams. Traded him to the A's for Bob Locker.
Yeah.
Bob Locker blew out his arm.
Yeah.
Cubs traded him back to Oakland. And then we got him back again for Billy Williams.
Right.
At the very end of Billy Williams' career.
Didn't they one time trade Bob Locker for himself? It's the only time in baseball history they traded
Dickie Knowles.
Oh, they
Dickie
did the
Knowles,
same.
Yes.
Right.
He's the one who was traded for himself. Right.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's
there are
beautiful.
Some interesting stories in here. I have to tell you that.
Several players, this is more for Wendy than for you, but several Cub players were also White Sox players. They not only Harry Carey performed for both teams, but a lot of other guys did too, huh?
Yeah, that's true. In fact, one of them has a copy of this book. That's Steve Trout.
Oh, really?
He
yeah.
came to an appearance I was doing in Orland.
Yeah.
And I gave him a copy of the book, and he read his entry, and he said, well, that's not true. There was something in here that he said wasn't true about a burrito eating contest. And I said, well, I watched a video of your teammates saying that you did this.
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, well, maybe it was true.
Oh, yeah. He gave
so,
in on that.
You know, I don't know. I don't know if it's true or not, but Steve Trout, if it's not true, we'll take it out of the next edition.
When your book arrived the other day, I started looking up YouTube videos of some of the players in there. And there was an afternoon. Now, this guy did not play for the Cubs. He played against the Cubs. But see if you remember the day that Mark Lemangelo of the Houston Astros had a blow up in Wrigley Field. Do you remember this?
No.
He had I've seen a lot of arguments in baseball, but this was him and the umpire. The umpire called a ball a strike or a strike a ball. I don't remember, but he was not happy with the outcome, and he just kept running around and flipping the umpire off.
I missed that.
And to WGN's credit, maybe the cameraman didn't know what he was watching.
We're number
he
one.
He kept it on him the whole time. It's insane.
I missed that.
Oh, it's great. Bummer. You got to watch it. Mark Lemangelo, they pronounced his name, but we called him Lemangelo because it's
like
delicious.
That. Yes. Yeah. Have you, you've done a lot of interviews for Every Cub Ever, a comprehensive guide to everyone who wore the uniform from 1871 to 2018. Rick Kempfer in the studio with us. You've done a lot of interviews. Has anyone brought up a name that you forgot? You haven't forgotten anyone,
Not
have you?
Yet. Not yet.
I thought Bill was going to be the one.
There were a couple people who told me what, you know, I've been actually getting quite a few emails from descendants of players, you know, and there were two that sent me emails saying that their father played for the Cubs and they're not in this book. And I looked it up, and they never played for the Cubs. They might have been in the minor leagues, or they got to a certain point, and maybe in spring training or something. But
did they tell their families that they did it?
Yes,
point?
Exactly.
Oh,
so that as they're growing up, they're hearing this story, and unfortunately, it wasn't true.
Oh.
So.
And you had to be the one to tell
them.
I had to
be the bad guy. Yeah.
Who are your favorite brothers that ever played for the Cubs?
Oh, boy. I kind of like the Breedens. Do you remember?
Hal Breeden.
And Danny Breeden.
And Danny Breeden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What'd they do?
Well, they were on the team that I loved the most in the late 60s, early 70s.
At the same time the brothers were?
Yeah.
One was a catcher, I think. One was a first baseman outfielder.
We also must remember, of course, the Russell brothers.
The Russells.
Rick and Paul.
Yes.
I love them. Know of Rick.
Who were sturdy.
Yes.
Is that the most polite way of describing that?
500 pounds of rock, bropping, stomping, pitching from those two guys.
Very sturdy fellows, the Russell brothers.
You did a great job on this, Rick. I can't tell you how proud I am of you.
Thank you. I appreciate
it. And what a great Father's Day gift for Cubs fans or just baseball fans.
That's true. EveryCubEver.com is a place you can get it, or at EckhartsPress.com is another place.
And someone could do a version of this about the White Sox if they wanted
to.
They
could, and I know a publisher.
Yeah.
A publisher.
Oh.
Jimmy Mack, are you listening?
Yeah.
Maybe he
can
do
work.
It.
That would be excellent.
Talk to you in 10 years.
Rick, congratulations.
Thank you very
much. It's a fun book. It's Every Cub Ever, available wherever books are sold. Every Cub Ever by Rick Kempfer. We'll take a break and we'll get you, we'll switch things over as Steve comes in with the Wintrust Business Lunch.
And coming up, the stories that matter with Jen DeSalvo from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.